Try to come with the debate, get things done. We've like to restart pledge allegiance.
Sure.
We don't help you get.
Yeah.
You want to start us?
Sure.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good to meet you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Yeah, you will.
Our country's hurting, and I think we need it, so. Do you have anybody from the public? Anybody from Select Health that wanted to speak up?
I'll speak up later. Just everybody's got to have all their screenings done. Yeah, make sure they're good tip top shape.
Does anybody from the public have anything to say about the motor vehicle thing?
I think we should probably have some introductions. That would be my recommendation.
Okay.
Visitors here today.
Why don't we start? I'm Stephen Wade. I believe I'm considered to be the acting chairman. So I'm an auto dealer with dealerships in Provo and Southern Utah and Washington.
Kirk Schneider, former auto dealer, I guess. I'm still sold my dealership to the Garth Group a year ago, so. But still serving on this board.
I'm Darren Bedeau, Darren Bedeau RV. Got a store on 21st and I-15, one up in Missoula, Montana. Hitting it hard for the RV industry.
What lines do you carry?
New, I've got Coachman Catalina product, Evo, which is Forest River. And then Thor product, those are the two big ones, Thor and Forest River. Torque, Sandpiper. We carry the Stellar product. And Shasta up at the Montana store. And then we've got a camper line we carry up at the Montana store also. Service parts.
Big area to cover.
It is.
Yeah.
It gives me an excuse to go to Missoula.
Area that he enjoys though.
Yeah.
Maybe extra activity.
Right.
Yeah, that's good country.
Randy Sugihara, SS Auto Brokers, SS Psycho Brokers. I'm also the president of Independent Dealers Association. And happy to be here.
Sonia Jorgensen, Jorgensen Motors, longtime used car dealer and also executive director of the Independent Auto Dealers.
Thank you.
Jason Bickmore, new car dealer.
Craig Bickmore, new car dealer.
You related to?
I'm going to say Gary.
Yeah, Gary.
Yeah.
That was my uncle, yeah.
He was a cool dude.
Yeah, he was a cool kid.
So you're the Jorgensen and Mitchell?
Yeah. Used car dealer.
It's Good Valley. No relationship at all?
Not that I'm aware of. I know that my husband had a lot of family down in Central Utah, but my family's all in Fairview from my dad's side.
My wife's got a aunt who's married to a Jorgensen down in Sigur.
Okay.
Which is east.
Phil McAfee, MBED. Larry Ball, Director of the ED.
Alan Shinyan with Tax Commission. Anyway, I'd just like to say that I'm extremely grateful for everyone's intent today. I think it's important to recognize Sonia Jorgensen as she is representing the new used dealers of the state of Utah. There was a change and they've reorganized and we've been attending their meetings. And I will say for the 24 years I've been with NDB, this is by far the most support that I've seen on the used car side for a long time, where there seems like a unified voice and they're really willing to participate in a fair and equitable way to resolve industry issues across the state. So I'm excited to welcome her. She will be in all intents and purposes representing what used to be occupied by Wayne and Adam Jones.
Wonderful. That's a big job.
It is. Thank you,
Alan. Thank you for what you're doing.
And Alan came in to our first annual convention. We had 110, 120.
I think we always want to be supportive of you with the new car side as well. And it's about all about representing the public properly. Help me, where's our crossover of any, what you said, independent?
Independent and unions are the same. Independent just means we're not franchised.
So we work together. Oh, he's coming soon.
Yeah, independent is just not franchised. Independent and unions are the same.
So you're all on your board. Thought maybe there was some form, because of oversight or something.
Oh, yeah.
No, we're just both camp.
We got two guys need to introduce themselves.
My bad, I apologize for that.
Speak up.
Clint.
All right, Clint Martin, owner of AutoMax. Been an independent dealer since 1998. Happy to be here.
Hi, Clint.
Hi, Clint.
Hi, guys. I'm John Weiss. I'm out here in Vernal today. I've got stores in northern Utah, eastern Utah, and southwestern Wyoming.
My name is Jason Gardner. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs of the Tax Commission. So anytime any legislation comes from the legislature or any rulemaking changes need to happen, I would be the one coordinating with the legislature, with the commissioners on those rule changes or legislative changes.
Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. Well, if we have nothing else then from the public, no comments, we'll move forward and talk about the minutes of the last meeting. Has everyone had a chance to look at those?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion that we accept the minutes as presented.
I'll second that.
Okay, is that John?
Clint.
Clint, thank you. Clint makes a motion in a second. We have right here, my right. So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone struggle with those? No nays? Thank you. Well, let's talk about, can we end a session? You want to talk about any concerns that you have and tell us what you think?
Well,
we need to do here.
Well, there's, you know, there seems like there's, we just got done with the new dealer tour, and like it's like Sonia said, we spoke of views. I am happy to report that, in my opinion, and I did validate some of the research that was done by Cox Automotive people. Utah, our economy is really well in Utah. Things are going really well. There's a lot of things that we're working on as regulators to protect the motor vehicles that are coming into our state. We're going to be working on a lot of Montana LLC issues with our state and what we believe to be a crime. And we're going to aggressively be seeking after those things this year. Like aggressively, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we're working on some, we're actually doing some meetings coming up here with Montana to, they've done some law changes, and we are going to draft off of their coattails an enforcement action plan for the state of Utah. So that's where we're at. I know that I'll be having more information next coming week, but we intend to start doing random enforcement to, we've already got four cases in right now that we're looking on.
Yeah, probably a couple more than they just got.
And then we're going to
all tax issues.
Yes.
With them buying.
Just people forming an LLC.
Correct.
And then licensing their cars.
50 plus in one address that don't exist. All kinds of violations like that. We pulled them on Google Maps. There's no location there. They use the strip malls, and there's a web page. You know, most of the dealers have cooperated and given us those information. So these are things that we're definitely, the tax commission's philosophy is we're not going to impose on the dealers to not make a sell, but we would ask that you not help them come up with a plan to avoid that, because it's, we have spoken to dealers in the past about directing clients to web pages that do that. It's unethical, and our attorney's interpretation, it's illegal. So we'd ask that, please don't, that would be the path of our investigation as far as involving a dealer. Outside of, we will be going in to pull records, and we could do that anyway, but we're definitely going to be doing that.
It seems to me if that's being done, that there'd be a pattern. Wouldn't just be isolated. It'd be more than one. You'd have a pattern of a group. You could go back. That's happening.
It's happening.
Yeah.
Or dealers are promoting it through their.
It's not as much now because I think we sent out bulletins over the last 2 years, but it obviously in your line of work and RV sales, it's quite popular. But to say that they're advertising it now, I don't believe that. I haven't seen anything for a while, but it's definitely happened before.
But the state of Montana is just allowing them to use bogus addresses to form the LLCs.
They are.
Check that out.
They are, and they are working with us right now. I met with the lieutenant colonel at a conference in Arizona, and he says they're working. So they're talking about some law change that will prohibit that, but I don't know if it's going to, it'll just change the dynamics of it, I think.
Well, I know in our case, when we have someone that does they have a Montana thing, we do a deep dive because we've been charged back for that over the years. I'm not lately, but years ago, I remember coming back and they charged us to pay the tax.
You'd be responsible.
Yeah, so we do a real deep dive when somebody, we want to see the address, we want to try to check it out, we do everything to cover ourselves.
What kind of enforcement action would you take?
It's 100%, I believe Jason Gardner's listening, it's 100% penalty on the sales tax side, and that's really what we're trying to establish.
You're going to send out a letter of amnesty? Come forward, pay your tax, and we'll.
We could present that to the commissioners and see if they would support that, but in all fairness, it's always been in the law anyway. Yeah. I mean, they're in my neighborhood, you know, I mean, they're all over the place. I've seen them.
See a lot of like Lamborghini SUVs with
them. So we're going to come up with we will let the dealers know what our plan is, but.
We'll let the dealers help you.
Yeah. We've been this far without the support of the industry. So we're going to do what we can do. Cox said that Utah is, believe it or not, has pretty much been recession-proof with their sales. Our sales are down. I think they were down, but they seem like they rebounded. I checked the permit sales. Permit sales are staying steady. And for that to be me to be reporting to you is actually really good because we're still in pretty good inflated sales ratios where we're way ahead of what our ratios were before the pandemic started. So we didn't expect that. And to stay the status quo, new dealer sites are starting to get more inventory back on. So things are seem like they're kind of back online, but there's no doubt. Well, in my opinion, there's a big gap. The gap now is bigger ever than before between the price of a new vehicle and a used vehicle. And those prices are coming up on the used side. I was just down at a dealership having my truck service yesterday, and it's a 2022, and the same exact truck, less equipped, is about $19,000 more. That's a big difference.
Wow.
So, wow. And they said it was done by the manufacturer. And I believe them, because I looked at MSRPs all across the board, and that's what they are. So, you know, it is what it is. There's still a lot of growth. Utah still, according to our office, is the fastest growing state in the nation. And there's a little bit of a debate between whether Idaho is or not. No one goes to Idaho, right? And the other place in Idaho, right? But no one moves to Idaho or Utah. And we really have to be that bolster and say we got to protect our interests in our state. So I think the governor is doing an outstanding job on dealing with economic issues as well as the advertising our state is a great place to thrive. We have a great workforce here. And I think that does, I don't think it, why am I bringing it up? Because it does affect the industry. And I'm proud to announce that to you, that I think moving forward, things are looking good. But I also think that we need to do a better job of, representing, I think the goal should be repeat customers for dealerships. Is it really all about making that one sell and get them out the door and say, oh, we got those guys good? It really should be about the repeat sale and building a name and helping the industry, whether it's used or new side in Utah. And I think, in my opinion, it doesn't affect the people in this room, but it does people in the industry. Because I guarantee you there's not one person in this room that hasn't had customers come in bad-mouthing your counterparts saying, they did this to us, they did this to us. And that just doesn't really help us. A lot of that's not true, by the way, but some of it is. So I hope as a board that we can have discussions on those things and deal with those issues, because we always have. So I anticipate now with the involvement of the used car side as a better representation than I've ever seen, we will be able to have better accounts of what's going on. So that's really all I have to say. Larry?
You know, I really believe that's our role though here as this committee. Just one set of examples, number one. And then where we see, even before they get to your level, when we see amongst ourselves, those that are not doing what we need, we believe they should be taken, things should be done.
There's definitely a lot of title issues too, like, you have to be very careful on the cars that you're acquiring, especially on the used car side. Knowing full well what you're buying is what you see is not always what you get. We are really working on some title issues with Kentucky. There still always have Ohio state issues. Florida is really got an ironclad system, but a lot of states are buying parts only cars, not suitable for registration, washing them, and then they're ending up in our state, like at monumental amounts. And where it comes into effect on the used car side, even on the new car side, because there's been new dealers that have got these, just because there's a title and registration in Utah, if you sell it to an out-of-state customer online, doesn't mean that that state's going to issue a title. And Larry, we have a couple of cases right now where these were total lost vehicles. They were not suitable for registration. They weren't supposed to be back on the road. They were cleaned up. They came to Utah. Idaho saw, even though there was a Utah registration title, decided that it wasn't roadworthy and they were not going to let that be on the road. So the dealer had to take the vehicle back. So just because you have a Utah title registration doesn't mean that it's going to transfer out of state lines. So just be aware of those things. You know, it really, some of those things could be subject to legislative interpretation and they could get a lodging. But right now, that's the way things are here. And if it comes on our title, whether it's clean or branded or whatever, we issue a title. Utah is not an initiating state where if a vehicle comes in with a salvage certificate or a loss, we're going to clean that vehicle. It's going to stay in the state that it is in when it comes in. If that makes sense.
It does, but you don't look at the title history. I mean, if it comes in with a clean title because somebody cleaned it in Kentucky, you're not looking before that like Idaho did.
And Montana's doing the same thing now. They're looking back at the history. They'll see Florida said it's a junk vehicle only, parts only. Went to Kentucky, got cleaned. Sold in Utah to a Montana LLC. Montana will register. Now the dealer wants a Utah title for it. And they're not going to get it.
But you're saying you have issued Utah titles on these things. And you're not. So should we be looking back and not issuing Utah titles?
Yes, I believe you should. That's...
Especially if you see something from Kentucky.
What services do the other states that you guys use for that?
This is one that I could send the links to Sonia and to Craig, and you guys can disperse them to your members.
Excellent.
It's a free access. I've got it today. I sent it to you, right?
Yeah.
We can send that out to you. I called Pamela today, got authorization to disperse it. It's different than Carfax, okay? I'm not saying it's better than Carfax, but it's different than Carfax. It is live DMV data, the best way accurately entered into the system.
And that'll give you the whole history of
it. Yeah, it'll list it state by state. And if it's been branded in Florida, it'll have a little notation on that tell you this vehicle is not suitable for registration, parts only.
Are you seeing those cars coming through the auctions?
Yes.
Well, you can go back on the auction.
No, there's nothing to go back.
Well, so you can't get it registered and you can't go back?
No, you can in Utah, you just can't in some other states. We look at Nambitas as a reference. We don't make a determination off of what Nambitas says. We go by the paper. So if it comes in on a title, we issue a title. Let's say if it came in through another state, they have a process where they can clean it and inspect it, like Illinois. Illinois does they do a total rebuild program. They have inspections in like four different areas. Those are suited back for registration. They have a rebuild restore title. We would title those in Utah accordingly.
Now, rebuild, restore.
Correct.
You'd
clean it. We would, whatever status it comes in, that's the status we issue. if there's an immediate alert, we can open up an investigation and look into if there was fraud. We can only make a recommendation to the DMV based on if we find fraud. That's hard to do. We're really watching it closely, but it's a factor. And there is some. I have made recommendations on ones I believe to be fraud, and we were unsuccessful. When a dealer makes $30,000 profit on a sale of a 2021 diesel truck, I don't know very many. You make $30,000 profit when you sell a car? Randy, do you?
Yeah.
If you, I would quit right now if I could make $30,000 profit on a car.
I have a question, Al. What's the time frame for you guys recognizing this? I remember years ago, we were dealing with this out of Colorado, and it's like they knew they had a 30-day window to get them here, get them sold, and then they're out of the picture.
That is the million-dollar question, and that is what we struggle. Jason Gardner, attorneys, works with us daily on that. There's just variables that are out of our control. Like an insurance auction, a lot of times are half the problem. They will hold the information until that car has been sold out of state, then they put in that VITAS alert in.
And Kentucky changed their method of operation. It used to be they'd give you a clean title and send it through. Well, now they realize, well, you can just do a branded title and you're not going to be searching as much. They think they can get that through because Florida had a branded title. Well, their brand is, it should be crushed, and theirs isn't. It's going to be crushed, and it comes through.
So what can we tell our members, the used car community, to do to watch out for these?
Run a Carfax.
And run it through the system.
And just for the record, we need to say that you are here. For the people who aren't here, we've got Nick Marcosian here from IADA.
He's our vice president.
We have people on Zoom.
Oh, hi.
Yeah, Carfax, I'm not endorsing any product. If you know a better way, like Auto Check's another one, I would do everything in your power to protect what the asset you're acquiring, what you're trying to sell to your people, knowing full well that governments make mistakes and there's things that lag on that are out of their control, mainly the insurance industry. The insurance auctions are a nightmare that you never know. I mean, you just got to know. I mean, the auctions are culpable to a point. They make announcements, but even then, the titles are not in their name. They're open in the titles. Now, we are seeing a very common thing in Nevada and other states. If it goes from dealer to dealer, Nevada and I believe Washington, Oregon are following suit on this. They want a title in a dealer's name that's going to their office. So I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of that. Do not panic if that happens to you. We will issue you a title. So if you get a call back from the auction saying you sold this car, they can't complete it on the out of state, just all you have to do is call myself, Larry, or Cole, and we will issue you a title based on how you acquired it and that you had the paperwork anyway. So that's on the rise. I think Arizona is doing that too now.
Yeah, they are.
So just be aware of those. Those are last year or so.
So Alan, it sounds like we're close to the point where we maybe need to start telling the dealers to get a title basically on every vehicle they purchase.
That would be, if you want to say the word best practices, what I hear a lot, that's probably not bad. I would ask that you work with us so we can find out a better way, because right now that would be a huge increase of volume. And I'm not going to say the other dealers have done that. Like Tim Daly had to buy back 3 cars and he got very upset about that. That we have titled every vehicle in their name, every vehicle at every location has done exactly what Clint just said. So if you wanted to do that, we would probably have to do that at our level or figure out a different path. It's possible. I would have to get some resources available to do that. If someone asked, I can't do something differently for somebody else. If you wanted it done, we could look at that.
So basically modifying the request, look and see what state they're coming from based on that, then get a title on every vehicle. An example, Kentucky, what you've mentioned a few times.
Well, but that, I mean, it works to sell the car in Utah, but if you sell it out of state, it could come back to you.
Absolutely.
But it's what you're saying.
Yeah, even if you have a Utah title, that's not going to make a difference in Idaho or in Nevada. Nevada, they have a different level of the VITAS interpretation. They will go back indefinitely in time. And we look for transactions. There's no doubt we want to look at transactions. They will go back if there's an alert 10 years ago and say, oh, It was a total loss. It's rebuild, restore title. Oh, it was a destruction of property title. We're not going to issue a title.
Idaho's doing one right now that was 8 years ago that they're doing right now.
We don't work for Idaho. I can't. I don't even. There's nothing to do about it. So yeah, we do the best we can.
But if it was totaled 8 years ago, it's totaled today. I mean, it didn't get better.
Well, there is processes like up to what, 5 years ago, you could have cleaned the title in Utah by an inspection problem.
Right.
If it didn't meet the threshold of damage, there's other things you could have. We don't do that anymore. We try to be consistent and say, this isn't what, that wasn't what the intent was.
You don't do that anymore where you can like follow the process of it being restored and get it cleaned entirely? Okay, that's good to know.
And we did it for a lot of, this was a revolving door. So why we're talking about this is why we decided not to do it.
You're still doing 2 miles unknown though, right? If you can document that that it's working properly and you bring it to a police officer.
Well, that's a good question, are we?
Repeat that slightly again.
It used to be that if you bought a car that the mileage was questionable, you could have a police officer come inspect the car and they give you a clean bill of health and then you can get actual mileage.
There's a way, if it's a Utah record, if it's an out-of-state record, you'd have to go to that state to fix it. Even those are difficult. I'm not going to deny that. They're like.
Yeah, I mean, they're sorry.
We tried to help you on with it, right?
If it's all Utah, it happened in Utah, yes, we can probably work through it. But if it comes from out of state, no.
Sometimes though you get, I mean, it's like the auction rights, the you know, transposes a couple of numbers, so it's not off very much.
Yes.
But it's above instead of below, and you know.
That's a clerical error. We can usually overcome those. The longer time period, it makes it more difficult. If it's like something like that, the sooner we find out about it, the better.
I saw that most recent news story where somebody sold a car that was like supposed to be $88,000 or something like that, and it was really $128,000. Yeah. A woman's been trying to get her money back. That came from out of state, like.
Yeah. I remember reading that.
It was exempt, so the dealer didn't know.
Yeah, we would always take a complaint on that. We track it out of state. Once it's out of state, if there's no fraud on the dealer's part or the seller's part, we refer them to the motor vehicle division in that geographical area.
Yeah, and if he exempted it, there should be a problem.
Right.
Is it?
And when you say exempt, you got to be aware of the federal law. The federal law changed about, what, 3 years ago? It's 20 years now. So it's
2011.
2011 and newer now.
They don't keep records. No, 2011 and newer, it's for 20 years. Anything previous is back to the 10. Yeah, 2011 is a cutoff. 20 years.
2011?
That's when it started.
So it's 20 years now, but they said we'll start at 2011.
Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry, I thought
you were saying that. And so even if there's a discrepancy in our Utah law versus what a DMV technician will do as far as their odometer requirements, doesn't mean that if a federal agent comes in and evaluates you for financing violations or whatever, you'll be expected to have an odometer disclosure statement, even if you've checked it exempt. So just keep that in mind. That's in federal code. Because we've had dealers call us up squawking about that.
So Alan, this is John.
Yes, sir.
Is where the fraudulent intent of this comes into play more than some of these other things. Is there nothing that we can do as a state to push back to the origin, whether that be through the auction? I know we as dealers, it comes back to us whether we have legal leverage or not. If the guest is unsatisfied due to this fraudulent activity, it's on our shoulders to make it right. It would seem to me as though there's, and if this becomes a bigger and bigger problem, people washing their titles, that it should go back to the origin as far back as we can take it. So that may be to the auction, but isn't there something a little bit more proactive that maybe we can do rather than just reactive?
I promise you that we're doing everything we can to do that, but when we have such a mass quantity of vehicles coming in from so many areas so quickly, I mean, I know both of you, Nick and both of you guys go to the auction weekly. How many cars? Those cars aren't all Utah cars. It's like very difficult, and they don't even know how long they've been in the other auctions for. So sometimes that data doesn't really come live, and it doesn't come live until, or even where we can see it till a new title is generated. It's very difficult. I mean, the auctions have put their hands up there and say, we're a facilitator. We're not really doing this. We don't have no liability. Well, they do, because they're a dealer. In the state of Utah, they're a dealer. There's no auction license.
I guess that's where I'm pointing to is more the auction side than anything. Is they are the facilitator, and they are dealing with these on a much more regular basis than a dealer is. And if anybody is suited to research or to allow certain products to come through the auction, it'd be the auction themselves. So I don't have a solution. I'm just saying it sounds like it could be a problem. It could become a bigger problem.
I think it will become a bigger problem, but honestly, I'm more confident that we can deal with it through the associations now than we've ever been able to deal with it before. So it really comes down to, we only know about the things that we find out about. We need to have, and we do have a good dialogue with the dealers now. We have to know what you guys are encountering so we can bring things up for discussion through our commissioners, through our attorneys, and through other means of, if we have to get a law change, we have the resources to do that. So it's definitely a problem. We're aware of it. I feel like, I got to be careful how I say this, but I feel like I don't have total, I don't communicate with the DMV as well as maybe as I could, and it could work both ways, because they don't understand the legal ramifications of what a criminal episode is and what just moving paper is. Jason could chime in if he wants to disagree or agree, but that's a hard battle, and we're not unique. Every state has that same problem. So, and it's not the DMV clerical issue to solve these problems. It's our investigation that has to happen for us to make a recommendation to the DMV to fix it. We just have to have the information. And it's not always about you guys taking your car back and ruining your reputations, but hey, I think I was wrong here. I need to have this looked into. If a complaint's done, I think we'll look into it.
Yeah, Alan, I think the tension is between, that you highlighted, between motor vehicle enforcement and just a strict DMV process is that cost benefit analysis. You know, the resources you dedicate to transfer, you know, doing the clerical aspects of it to a certain degree will have to give to some of the due diligence aspects of it, of checking for historical, historical titles, and same kind of thing. The dealers, the same situation for the dealers, honestly. I mean, they're just trying to weigh their cost benefit analysis between, you know, making the sale and also the amount of time and effort that's put into making that sale. And so I think that's the tension all around is what's the right amount of due diligence on these to make the customer happy, reduce liability, and, you know, make the transfer.
With the tax commission reorganization in July, we have constant meetings with the DMV over these very issues. So I think we're going in the right direction. We just need, in all fairness, I think we're looking for the perfect type cases to make, to change some things. We just really haven't really had them.
We haven't had a perfect case.
There hasn't been like the perfect one. I'm not saying there's not cases there. It's just not the perfect one to say, see, we got to stop this. And once that happens, I think we'll be golden.
It seems like through the years, Alan, you've dealt with this every year, and it seems like they're getting smarter and more states are jumping on board because it's a revenue stream for them. I know you dealt with Colorado years ago on this. Like, is Illinois, Kentucky, they don't care that they cause us the problems they do?
They don't care that you're angry with it.
So on the auctions you brought up, in years past, auctions have always been the big boy. And if we get one of those, and, you know, they've always kicked us to the curb, like you guys go figure it out. It was this dealer that sold it. At least, like you say, we're the middleman. Our hands are clean. Is there any way to hold the auction responsible? Seems how they're the ones that are, you know, representing that vehicle at the time of sale.
Yes.
Because the dealers, whether big or small, usually end up in their lap.
If it's criminal and there's a fraudulent intent, there's always a way. I might not be able to prosecute them in Utah, but we can do it through NHTSA, through the Department of Justice. It's just, they want volume. I'm not going to get a one-car dealer doing that. I'm going to need like 20. And if they're doing it once, they're going to do it again. And they learned it somewhere. Those are not easy to do, but yes, we watch those all the time.
But are all these vehicles coming through the auction, or are they multiple sources that are
multiple sources?
Curbing. auction, dealer to dealer transactions. I mean, it's a combination of all, it's the whole business.
So on our end, what we could do for you is make sure that we document, get you in touch with every time we hear, because I know a lot of times people just deal with it and move on.
New dealers take your cards on trade, don't want to do nothing about it because they don't want to affect their sale, but then they got to punt it to another, do another used car dealer, try to sell those online. Those are the type of cars we need to, the quicker we find out about those things, the faster we can do something.
Do you see them coming off any of the stoppage lots? You know, obviously Utah's become a huge salvage state.
Yeah, we have huge salvage dealers in our state now, so the problem's not going away. Obviously, you have Auto Lucidity up north, you have Auto Savvy, you have CJ Pressman. I mean, we have, there's a ton of them. There's even smaller ones. We have GP Motors.
GP Motors, there's a lot of Velocity.
Velocity.
Yeah.
There's a ton of them, and they've made a niche, and they're selling a ton of cars, gentlemen. You're talking 100 plus cars a month.
So more than that, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that as long as they're disclosing.
Yeah, they are.
Customers know what they're getting, which they do. They do a really good job with transparency. It's just if the car is being misrepresented in some way, obviously that's when it gets ugly.
If it shouldn't have been on the road again, huh?
Yeah, that's the there's a big area there because the form requires they do a disclosure form. But that doesn't say that if it's been a significant exposure, doesn't say that the airbags have been repaired. There's all these other things that go into it, and if they knew, then it's a crime.
So, yeah, that's true. I mean, I've been a long time since I...
But it seems like they've been in business a long time, and if it were a problem, they wouldn't be in business anymore, right? Or am I being naive?
You're probably being a little naive. I wish there's a lot. We try to do everything that we can. But a lot of times the guys, you know, to be honest with you, the used car dealers don't want to make complaints against another competitor. If we had those complaints, then we'd have more teeth and more validity to talk about.
Well, and I think those could come through me.
Yeah,
I remember that's one thing I remember with Wayne is he said, send them to me and I'll be the bad guy reporting them to MVED. You know, then it's not you guys.
Yeah.
I can think of a lot of ways we could get the word out.
Don't misunderstand my statement, but I think as a franchise dealer, we're held a little different standard. I know Bradshaw, and years ago, either he did it or somebody came back to Speed Oliver in that Porsche store, and St. George, he lost his franchise. And you, for that, I mean, what's his franchise worth? What's it worth today? And it's not worth, it's more than a slap on the hand. So any new car franchise dealer in his right mind has got to be very, very careful. I mean, we don't, to my knowledge, we're structured, all of our people, we get 700-800 employees, you lose track, but we're instructed not to buy a car like that, not even have it on our lot.
Well, I think like Alan said, though, it's easy to just wash your hands of it and say, save it on trade, get it over to Nick, you know?
Yeah.
I don't take that car.
I think right now, what we would ask of everyone is to pay attention to the dealer-dealer transactions where a dealer's not paying you. I guess if you guys are banks and you can float credit lines to other dealers, be careful what you wish for, because I think if certain things change overnight and they can't pay you and they owe you for one car, then it turns into five cars and 10 cars. That's 10 victims out there too, but on the customer side, that my philosophy is we're going to help those customers get titles to their cars. So I don't let those cars float to other dealers. If they're not paying you, file a complaint. They're licensed and bonded. If you don't file a complaint and you think you're going to get the money out of them, they're just robbing from Peter to pay Paul. And eventually, the rug's going to be pulled out from underneath them. So be careful with that.
It just points out again the value of what you do for all of us and how important your role is that you play from a motor vehicle standpoint. That we all try to make it better for ultimately the customer, who none of us wants hurt. But we don't want the challenges of having to get bruised in the interim.
Well, I think, did you want something to raise your hand?
I was just going to say, how many calls on the bond has there been you see an uptick of that, downtick. I don't know the people.
Is it up?
It's up. And don't you agree with that? It's way, it's gone way up.
Way up, really?
What do you think the cause of that is?
Don't know. I mean, we're just, everybody thinks that the dealer's got big pockets, and so they ask for the bonds they can assume. It's over everything. It's over mechanical issues that we don't deal with, and it's everything. They want the bond to see what they can get.
Well, they're not gonna get any claims on it.
They're not gonna, no, they're not gonna get them, but they're still requesting them.
So is it dealer to dealer calling the bond, or is it customer calling the bond?
It's mostly customers, isn't it?
Really?
It's just legal, legal attorneys. It's a way to shortcut it.
What is it from dealer to dealer on the bond? Is there any of those?
I don't think we've seen any real dealer to dealer ones. It's all customers.
Because they're the ones who go after the bond for the money to be reimbursed for the vehicle.
And we didn't used to see any for a long time. We've been averaging probably two or three a week in the last little bit.
Really?
I've seen an uptick in civil suits too, because I always get called. They say, you know, do you want this? Will you take this and, you know, file suit against this dealer? And I just always say, no, I'm gonna flip it out. But I've seen a lot more dealers in, I mean, a lot more lawyers in my network saying, yeah, resume, we'll go after them, even on like as is things. And there are a couple of lawyers who are trying to make a name for themselves saying that they can win these suits.
Yes, it is.
Stresses me out, you know, I don't like it. And no, I'm not saying you buy those cars. I was just saying that's what the new car dealers say. Hey, call a used car dealer to take care of this for us.
We do. We have people who know that. What?
Absolutely.
Especially if it's a good car. We know it's a good car or something, but let's let people do that. We just don't have them on our lot.
Another issue is Alan got an email from a local financial institution and a copy of a contract to sell. And they've got all sorts of crazy fees in there. They got a property assessment fee, processing fee, inspection fee of $178, a dealer admin fee of $1,000.
Is that the doc fee? What is
yeah.
that fee?
You don't know this that doesn't is. Say doc fee in here.
What contract is it on? Is it on a Utah contract?
Yeah. And
See, the good thing is that was from your meeting that I met the American First people there. We're sending a meeting. They're sending us information.
It's crazy.
We cannot as an industry allow that to happen.
Yeah.
Craig's been fighting the doc fee battle for 20 years. That'll like help that cause like go away fast.
Once we cross that line, it'll take it away. So what did you do when they sent you that?
We're going to go give them a ticket. They can't charge $190 for a safety inspection. That's a state mandate fee. It's a flat rate.
Well, there's no safety inspection.
Well, they can have safety inspection if it's rebuild or restore. But you can't charge $198.
Jeez. Well, if more of those, that's how you make that 30 grand.
If they're, they don't care. They're putting whatever in that accessory line they want.
If you have customers coming in to you telling you that, that's not bad to have them pay. You might want to call these guys and make that complaint because we found this out from America First.
Did the customer buy the car?
Yeah.
I mean, so they did. There is some, you know, what is the term?
It's like self
culpability.
Yes.
But look, I hear this all the time.
Well, not buyer beware.
This is across the board. So I went into the F&I office. They sold me all these products. I didn't even know what I was paying for. We hear that all the time.
Yeah, but you get a copy of the contract.
Well, the problem is,
I was tired. I wanted to leave.
Or consumer,
they tell us that all the time.
That's the new document that we just got passed the legislation as well because of that.
Or consumer protection gets involved.
It's just another, you know, short version.
Well, the problem is, most of the people are saying that this is a state mandated.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that deals a huge problem. I'm not minimizing it. That can't happen. That just
no. There are too many dealers out there. That other weird fight with the $1,200 undertow preload. You know, that's going to kick all of our butt eventually.
Undercoat?
Yeah, for $1,200. Yeah. So they'd advertise it at 50 grand for the truck. You'd show up, the truck was all of a sudden 51.2.
Undercoat, is that still a thing?
Pro or
even
edge. I mean, we live in Utah. We salt our roads. Come on, man.
I haven't done that code in about 30 years, but okay.
The point is, when they keep abusing that, it's going to get taken away.
Well, Craig talks about that all the time.
And it is a legitimate fee.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to share, we have copies if we pass this out. If if this is a good way, maybe to segue, you talked about disclosure. And the form we've worked on, I know that Sonia, you haven't seen his latest one. But can I pass it out to the group? I sent it to Jason, who's now Jason Gardner.
I thought Jason had it finalized already.
I don't know.
We just.
Finalized, Jason?
Yeah, this is the document I was just talking about.
It is, it's working its way towards finalizing. I was sending it for one final review, so. The one thing, looking at the form that you just sent me, Craig, I'm not understanding why we're subtracting optional charges from negotiated sales price on line 3. That doesn't make sense.
Oh, can I give just a little explanation? Maybe this will help, maybe it won't.
Yeah, go ahead.
We have spent, I know Sonia's looked at it, we have spent probably 150 hours if you take the people who've been on the calls. And so some of this stuff is, so finally on Friday, and we've had lots of people look at this, lots of people who obviously dealers and sell people. We went on Friday, Jason and I, and we sat down with some desk managers, finance managers, and other dealers who've given us input, and certainly Sonia, you haven't seen this, nobody has seen that just now. What we don't want to do is confuse the customer and cause a problem. We don't. It's about disclosure, it's about transparency. And so what we did, Jason Gardner, on this one, is we said, here's what the people said, well, they're just gonna get in the F&I office, and they're just gonna have them sign this, and it's gonna be the same old thing. That's what our people said. Same old thing, it's all a contract to sell. The language says, well, this just has to be presented to the customer before the sale is finalized. Well, when is that? That's just before they sign the contract to sale. So what good is this going to do? So what we didn't want to have happen, at least from our standpoint, was the spirit of the law was disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. Because just like we've all talked about, this is going to get us into trouble for the silly, stupid stuff that goes on. And so here was suggestions from 2 or 3. We just want to hear this document is not in stone. I don't think, like Jason Gardner said, we're working on the stage. We've had several iterations of this. And so we moved up the optional charges because people say, oh, what's in the negotiated cost? Here it is. And then you go down, optional used to be line 6. Well, that's far away from that. So we thought, what if we bolded it? What if we put it after negotiated sell so that people know, oh, this is a negotiated sell price that includes all of these items. Here are the optional things that we want to see. And then what they did was, if we had, who's on the call for it? John Watson, Gars, Tim Daly, Doug Smith, and their people on there. We've had several other folks to look at this. And they said, look, let's go through and see how a car deal actually worked. I've never worked a car deal personally. I have never done that. And so they went down to the really how things work. And they said, okay, you got to have the total sales price. And one of them said, 2 or 3 of them actually said, we're going to get in trouble if we don't talk about the trade-in value. So even though it's not in statute necessarily the way it is here, Jason, from a practical side, and these dealers up here, you 5, okay, you understand this stuff better than I do because you did this. And so we don't want the customer to have any confusion. So we said, okay, how does the contract to sell work? It works like this. So essentially you got a couple of documents that are about the same. It's just another layer of disclosure. So here's what you do. You gotta have the balance of the trade in there. How much is the trade in allowance? It's the sum. There could be negative equity in that. Well, that's not addressed in the statute. But from a practical side, we thought, how do we make this more transparent, more understanding? Because as Alan said, you get in here, and you've been in the store for 3 hours. Okay, let's just put everything on there. Then we get apart, then we get mad, then we get suits, then we get civil. We don't want that. So this is the way that, again, we wanted to share it. We knew it was here. We said, look, ladies and gentlemen, can we have a conference call this morning at 10? After we've been all through this again, so we can bring it to this group who are industry experts and see how this flows. So Jason Gardner, I don't know statutorily how this comports. We hopefully have got the statute thing. Sonia brought up the thought process from Jason that we put the salesperson's name on that one. Concerning on that one, several hands touched the deal.
I'm just saying who signed it though, so that it can be enforced. I mean, that's not fair. Somebody brings it to me and says, you know, enforce this. I'm going to go to the dealer and say, who signed it? You know, they're going to say, I don't know. That person's gone.
Yeah, well, it's, so it would it be the desk manager? Would it be the F&I manager? Would it be the sales manager? Would it be the salesperson? The final concern is the salesperson may not necessarily be the person who signs it. And so.
Whoever presents it.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a place here, dealer representative signature. So whoever that would be. So I don't know that that covers what you're concerned with or not. This is not our form. It's the state form that we're just trying to, from a practical standpoint, abide by the spirit of the law from Representative Jack.
So can I just ask a few questions then? So it appears that the way this form is structured, that negotiated sales price is including optional charges. So it's assuming that they are accepting those options.
Oh.
Because you have line one minus line two as total sales.
Shouldn't that say plus line two?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
I should say plus.
Yeah. Well, it says add 2A through 2D, right?
Yeah, but the next one says line one minus line two for total sales price.
Again, we went through this. We could have gotten some paginations wrong or some numbers.
Yeah.
So whatever we need to fix, that's our intent. Our intent was to completely separate negotiated sales price, which is by statute, with optional. So the people go, no, edge, window tint, undercarriage.
And the way I read the statute, negotiated sales price is distinguished from the optional charges. So because those are separately stated, and so negotiated sales price has to be something not including optional charges. So the only way for this to work, if you want to use it in this format, would be line two to be added to line one, and then you could say total sales price, and maybe even put a little a little parenthetical there that says with optional charges or something, because that's what you're doing there.
Well, three does. I think three describes that.
It's just minus on three.
One, but it's got the sales price minus the options.
So it has to be plus. Line one.
Well, we just made a typo there.
Okay, fair enough. And then secondly, online.
Oh, we had people look at. We've had so many people look at this. It's scary.
It's just like that they're both separate.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there any hope that we can just get the legislature to rescind this?
As far as dealers go,
no, not a chance.
This, yeah. Every dealer in the world will agree. This is way more complicated than a line item contract.
It is. It is far more complicated.
This is going to confuse more people than anything.
And to me, it's
the realization of the real world and card in the world and the purchasing world.
So here's the thought on this one.
I know we have to do it.
I agree with you. And back to your comment, Mark. It's Mark. Nick. I'm sorry, Nick Marco. Nick, there is no chance of that. And the reason there isn't is because they're just looking for this kind of excuse that Alan and Cole just said to eliminate this. So you all know. The reason we went through this, and we're grateful to have what we have, even though we don't like it. Don't answer the question. How many new and used cars do you sell? How many used cars do you sell, Nick, a year ago? Think in your mind. Okay. Times that by your dog fee. What's that worth to you? Give it yourself. How would you like to lose that?
So they did literally put on the table, you lose the dog fee and you did the state.
No, it was negotiated. This was negotiated by Craig into the forms. Whatever.
But it comes up a lot.
Oh, I know. Every year.
Yeah.
They actually allowed the dog.
Yeah.
They're trying to solidify the dog.
Yeah.
So I know
exactly what we had in mind.
I know you guys don't see this, but compared to what the FTC is trying to bring down,
right?
No, I know.
Yeah,
right.
It is, yes.
Nick, I wish this could go away. To bring this up again, if it changed it a little bit, maybe. But guess what? You open up.
Yeah.
We just got a thing from Gephardt, but we just got from a senator, from another senator. We just got it today.
Well, at least we can go back to this.
What about just trying to chase your motor vehicle contract, since it's the same thing? Well, because it has to be by statute, what Jason Gardner's saying, it has to comport with the words say. In statute, we have to have negotiated sale price. We have to have taxes and fees. We have to have, you know, we have to have.
But again, I'll log on to the only thing, only word you're changing is negotiated, right?
Hey, Jason, can this replace the motor vehicle contract sale?
I do not, you know, this shouldn't touch the motor vehicle contract sale.
It doesn't have the finance disclosure.
You obviously done way more than I have. It's just frustrating because it's so redundant.
Agreed.
Jason Gardner, I know I told you that I was looking at this as from a dealer standpoint too.
Yes.
And as a dealer, I don't understand how, and I can ask Craig and Jim, how 1A through H are different than 2A through B. Like, what are the dealers putting as the, what's included in the negotiated sales price and optional?
So some of this, in my understanding, some of this is going to have to be education. So here's the root of the problem. Go into the car deal, you go into the F&I office, and you go, oh, what are all those hard ads on the car? You didn't tell me about that. Edge, underco, tint, all those other kind of things. Well, that's what you said it was. You didn't tell me. That was the genesis of the bill. So what this was is the negotiated sale price is, hey, this is those advertised hard things on the vehicle that are non-negotiable. If you don't pay for ads, then you can't have the car. It's $499. We didn't tell you that. So the legislator said, look, whatever you negotiate the price, it includes ad, cab, whatever it is. If it's listed on there, that's the negotiated price. But you can sell whatever you want after, service contracts, whatever. So that's why we want to differentiate between the negotiated sale price and those options. So you don't get in there and have the customer say, well, that's not what you agreed to.
I don't see how the negotiated sales price is going to include any of those things though. Like I was saying, a car for 18 grand, but it's not going to include etch and dock and all those things. Those are going to be down below.
But what happens is this, that's exactly what happened, is that the negotiated sale price does include etch and all those hard ads. That's what he wanted to get away from.
So in the motor vehicle contract, it's going to say the sales price is 18 grand, for example, because that's what they negotiated with me. But then on this, it's going to be 18 grand plus the etch or the undercoating or whatever I included. Then what is on here? What is includes?
So negotiated sale price includes edge, gap, everything you negotiate with there.
So okay. That's what I'm saying. So the 18,000 that I negotiated, I agreed I would take, is going to be the top line on the contract. It's going to be, but it's not going to be the top line on this, because that 18 grand includes all these other things.
Exactly.
So that's not going to be the top line on the motor vehicle contract. It's going to be more.
Sonia, if I might be able to interject here, the way I understood these two, and obviously the lines underneath negotiated sales price, that's not in the statute. That was something that was asked to add, and that's fine. But the distinction between them that I see is, one is the customer can say, I still want to purchase the vehicle. I don't want that option. That they have the deal can still stay alive without them electing into the things in optional charges, but the deal dies if they don't want the things in the includes portion of the negotiated sales price. That's the distinction that I see.
I understand that. My point is that as far as on the ground, when we're doing this, the motor vehicle contract, that first line is going to be different than this first line, because this first line includes those things that.
All right. That's the problem, Sonia, is that in another deal, it didn't. And so those are the things that they come to. I've had this happen personally.
Shouldn't they be the same?
What Sonia's saying is
under the new, the first line under the buyer orders should be 18,000, which includes edge.
Agreed.
Everything agreed in this first line should be. And in fact, if you buy any accessories, I think that the second part is a little confusing, but if the car is 10,000 and etch is 500 and so on and so forth, and you get up to $12,000, that's your first line, and that's your first line on the buyer's order.
I think what she's saying though is on MBC, we have the 18,000, and then when you come down the line items, you have to have them printed out there, yeah. Or this is going to print them all in line one. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is Edge just included in the 911?
Price on this contract.
But I don't, why would you list them all out on the contract of sale when you have this document that actually.
Because you have to have an NBC on the NBC. Your options come down at the very tail end. Edge, warranty.
Because you're sending that to the finance company.
The NBC don't start here. The NBC on options start down here. So you're going to have two different prices on your first line on both contracts.
And that's why I think it's confusing. Yeah.
So honestly, we're just trying to do the best. I think we're all on the same page.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We just don't know how to get there.
Exactly. No, I'm not arguing with you, Craig, but this is fine.
We just tried everything we could, so we.
No, we appreciate all the time.
Yeah, I'm just clarifying that line one is different than line one of the NBC.
It could be. I mean, people send to me, "Dear, Craig, can't you fix this?"
I understand what you're doing.
That won't work. You'll have two. And you guys, this created a pile of arms for you guys. Now they come off and they say, "Hey, on this contract I pay 18, on this contract I pay 19 too."
That could be wrong.
And then you're going to you're going to just have to try to explain it to everybody. So I would look at that first.
So what you're saying is this negotiated sales price includes things that will not be on the line item on the MBC.
Correct.
So then it would be the same number, line one of this and line one of the motor vehicle contract, but those things don't need to be itemized like Edge and things like that.
They're not. That what happens is, so let me give an example of what happened. So, and it happens in the used car side, it happens in the new car side. So the level what happened, Representative Jack, personally him, the constituent, the relative, importantly, they get in there and probably say, "Here's my vehicle, 18,000, we choose 18,000. And there was things that are already included on the vehicle. This. And then what happened is the constituent, whatever, said, "Well, I don't want that." And they said, "Well, that's part of the car. You take it or leave it." And so they go, "Well, I don't want to pay this $300 this or $400 that." What he doesn't want to have happen is people get a price, go into the F&I office, and find out that those things are not optional. They're part of it. And so it's just trying to work around, how do we get the legs? How do we not do it confusing? Here's an example. I'm in a meeting. I got 15 leaders in there. And we talked about this. We talked about the legislation. You've heard me say this. And so we said, "Look, disclose this." So Saturday afternoon, I get a call from an attorney who I happen to know. And I hadn't seen him or talked to him for 2 years. He goes, "Craig, I'm in a new car store." He told me who it was. He said, "Can you tell me in statute or law where this $200 etch fee is?" I started laughing. He said, "No." And then I'll call the dealer. The dealer was in the meeting the day before. Do you think he knew anything about that? He did not. I called him on Monday. He goes, "One of four guys." Now, I don't think he killed him, but hope he doesn't have a job there. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to avoid. We don't know necessarily. We don't want to cause it more confusing, but what the intent of the legislator is that when you negotiate a price, you can't come back and say, "Well, I don't want that edge, or I don't want that other." You didn't tell me. That's the.
Hey, so, Craig. Yeah. Craig, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Would it be easier to keep the contracts as they are and to just have a document listing optional rather than having to go through the whole trail of how we got to a price? If we negotiated to $18,000 and I have Edge, I'd rather have them sign a document saying Edge is optional rather than to have my sales guy explaining Edge when he's not the salesman of Edge. It's my F&I guy or whatever other ancillary. So wouldn't it be easier just to list optional items and have a guest have that disclosed to and have them sign, then it would be getting back into what we call negotiated price. I don't even like the term negotiated price. But I get what we're trying to do. I'm saying, can we just list, because what you're saying happened can happen with everything. You know, if I knew this protected us for our doc fee, which I want to protect with all my life, and if that protected us forever, to not get rid of our doc situation, but who's to say that it isn't going to be the next thing that is going to be leveraged against our doc fee?
John, as long as the things that you have on the car are actually optional, problem is a lot of people are putting Edge or whatever, you know, a GPS or whatever they put on the car, it is not optional. They are
preloading.
They are preloading it, and the customer has to buy it. So as long as you're willing to say, hey, yeah, you don't have to take that. I'll just eat.
Well, like, well, for instance, etch. I mean, we preload etch just because we don't want to be out there etching our glass in delivery, but that costs you about $3 or something. So that issue, you know, but if you're putting like clear bra or undercoat or whatever, obviously that should be disclosed up front. I just don't understand. It's just going to get really complicated digging into the contract and disclosing all that. You're basically doing the job of the finance business manager, disclosing that before it even gets in the office.
I agree with John 100% on that. I would not let a salesperson in my leadership go through this with the customer. That's my finance manager job. He's been trained to do it. He knows the documents, you know what I mean? And I think this could be made much simpler by doing just optional charges as well. That just my take. I think this is going to confuse the consumer's big time.
The problem is, though, what the representative wants is it's got to be disclosed before he hits the F&I office, before the customer. That's the whole point of it, is so that you don't get in there and then you go, here's $350 for Asher.
Kind of back to what we,
walk out. Very interesting thing that Cox Automotive talked about on our trip. So let's say you buy the car online, okay? They said, right, correct me if I'm wrong, that majority of customers, when they see the itemized list, they will select more of those options regardless, because now they're seeing the price instead of being deceived, right? It said that. Yeah. So for me, it's like sometimes if you just let them have the option of choosing, because you give them a fair out the door price, then if they have a budget in mind, they will pick those other items and you won't have to trick them into getting them. That's what Cox Automotive said.
Well, my understanding that the reason this came about was the problem was, say the negotiated price was $18,000, but then all of a sudden it's $22,000, yeah. And they're going, what the hell? And they're saying, well, there was etch, you know, that's not included in that negotiated sales price. The problem is that it wasn't included in that negotiated sales price. They go back to F&I and find out, oh my gosh, I've got all these extra charges. You know, and I don't think that including it and saying it's part of that negotiated sales price is going to help, because they're going to negotiate. They're going to pay $18,000 on a $20,000 car. They talk me down to $18,000, and then they're going to come in here and see this one that includes everything except for these bottom things and go, no, I agreed to $18,000. Oh, well, but this includes all these optional things. You know, that's going to be spelled out with the F&I man.
So there's statutory things here that have to be in the disclosure. And so maybe Jason, and to answer to your question, John, I'm in agreement with everybody here. We have to conform to what the statute says. And Jason, that's what we've been trying to do with this form for the last 45 days, is how do we come up? How do we be transparent? How do we do chapter and verse the way it's supposed to be disclosed so that people aren't confused? We have to start all over again. I'm really good with that. We don't have the answer. Jason, you got any comments, thoughts on that? We don't know.
I thought that you had pretty much done, Jason. I liked the last version. I didn't know that there were still problems with it.
Yeah, negotiated sales price. We have to have negotiated sales price. However, the statute does not require a breakdown of what is included in negotiated sales price. That was something that was added later based on industry comments. That is not, if it's causing more confusion, it was meant to cause, to clarify, but it sounds like it might be causing more confusion than it is clarifying. The other idea of what it was intended to do was to basically, if this buyer takes this, gets this form that says negotiated sales price, and then goes to the dealer down the street, they're going to know what apples for apples is on this vehicle. They're going to be able to say, yeah, well, they negotiated $18,000, but it included these various things. Whereas if they take it to, you know, that may not be apparent if they just simply get a negotiated sales price without the itemization of what that includes. That may or may not happen. Maybe it's a non-issue. So maybe we can just strike that entirely. As far as everything else on the form, however, optional charges, those being itemized, that is statutory. That has to be on the form. No questions. The trade-in vehicle value, that has to be on the form. That's required by the statute, as well as the list of taxes and fees, that specific list, and dealer financing. So pretty much everything else on the form has to be there, including the signature lines.
So the itemized options are installed, pre-installed, correct?
So if it's an optional charge, it has to be included there. What optional, again, what that means is that's something the person can opt out of and not pay for.
But so not if, all my products, including Gap, Express, Chemical.
Yep. Anything that they cannot opt out of and still purchase the vehicle at that negotiated price is not an optional charge, right? Like optional charges would be if they want to buy an extended warranty. An optional charge might be something like that. It's built into the vehicle already and integral, that's not optional anymore. That's part of the negotiated sales price.
I think service contracts do not fall on this deal because that's something that's sold in the F&I office. Well, you would not be listed on this form.
So
this would be like if I wanted floor mats and a ski rack and a roof rack. And
so where's the warranty go? Where's the service contract?
That happens.
That's after this.
After this, that's once you're in finance, we can still sell service contracts.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
You don't have to sell that up front.
It's right there.
In the options, I don't even think the optional charges has to be comprehensive. I think that's just basically if you wanted to highlight to the person, there's these things that could or could not be affixed to the deal. You have the choice of having them or not having them, and still the negotiated sales price still remains the negotiated sales price. I think
one would not remain the same, which I see a conflict.
Are there other states that have similar forms of this that we could research?
California.
How does theirs look?
I'm sure
there's like so Rob Zandi is the compliance guy from Garbs, and they have a lot of stores in California. We've had, I don't know, 10 conversations with Rob. He said this form, yeah, we're not married to any of this. If you guys have suggestions, we're all over that.
I'm with making it easy as possible, and I don't think spend a ton of work on it, Craig, but looking at it here and what Kurt just said, I'm not gonna have a salesman out there punching a warranty. And if you're saying, well, these are just options, you say, hey, you can get a warranty when you go in there, you can get Gap, you can get this. And there's going to be a discrepancy from line two. If you go line two and one and add those together, have a bottom line here, and then when they get into the F&I office, it's going to be totally different. You've already had them sign this. I've had them sign my FEC contract and my bank contract, and then they come back 3 months later and say they gave me two different contracts.
So that was, Randy, you're exactly right. So actually, this can be done. So the intent with the legislator was to have it done before the F&I, but the legislation says it has to be signed prior to the deal being finalized.
Mm-hmm. Also, the note for which the licensee agrees to seek arrangements of financing is on here. Yeah. So the bottom line has to be on here. So like you're saying, Randy, you've got to have warranty and everything because this is the bottom line, the amount that they're going to seek.
We'll get our butts kicked in court, but
that's what line eight.
You brought that part up. So I talked to a county attorney's office up in northern Utah about this. So in the way the sales go down, a customer comes in, they sign the contract of sale, and they go into the F&I, and they don't want to sign this. You got a problem on your hands because the law says that if they sign the purchase agreement, it's not about delivery of the car, they own the car. And if they don't want to sign this, it's a violation. It's a violation of the new statute.
Well, but so, they're not going to sign a contract outside of the F&I office, hopefully.
This is supposed to be done before they go to
the contract. A lot of times, contracts are signed before they go to
the F&I. But Craig has clarified that too. That see, the sales before the time to sell that is before they go to the
F&I. That's right.
So originally, before the contract.
Originally, his thought was prior to the legislature, the legislation was when you get the F&I contract, which means for all intents and purposes, this is going to be in the F&I office side by side. The F&I person is going to say, look, this is a state disclosure. Here's all the things to make you understand, Ms. Customer, Mr. Customer, all the things that are negotiated price, all the options, all the taxes and fees, so you understand. Now let's go ahead and finish the contract and bid the contract itself. So kind of a double protection. Do we like it? No.
No, that's why I'm crazy.
It is simplified. That becomes totally redundant.
It does.
It is.
My idea, but you're right, was to say to the customer, look, this car includes Edge and GPS, and it's $1,000. So just so you know, the car is 18,000, but it's 19,000. So when you go to the F&I office, they can sell you a service contract and other things, but you're paying 19 grand. Now, if we're disclosing it all in the F&I office, it's totally redundant.
I agree.
Well, in my understanding, from talking to the representative.
Well, I didn't know that that was statutorily what it was.
Yeah, that's probably.
I think that we could talk about this, like, we could probably do a conference call because it's been on forever.
Yeah.
The real honest, though, you have consumers that walk in to a dealership. I'm walking into your dealership, and I'm going to go to you, your salesperson. I want an out-the-door price right now. And I do that all the time, trust me. And if I go into an F&I guy and he's like trying to jack me up, no, I want that price that I was given out the door. You could have a problem with the purchase agreement contract of this if I'm going to stick to what you gave me on the little paper. Are they right? You know, out the door price.
The four square.
So I'm just telling you that they need to be trained probably to know what the law says, what the contract law says, and what they could be, because it's a progressive fine. It gets up to $5,000 per incident, right?
Down from 10.
Yeah.
Down from 10. We were glad to get it.
The original bill was, the first penalty was $10,000.
$10,000. They're serious about it.
And I didn't want that set as a precedent where they could just throw other stuff in there to be.
So what we could do is, I think we could arrange a virtual meeting to go over these items. So we could talk about this forever. This probably needs to be discussed. We have a deadline July 1st.
Well, I have Alan's, I guess, I think this group here, now that you've seen this, is we've been working on this for a long time. So it's been such in motion. We completely changed it this morning at 10 o'clock.
But the bill actually takes effect June 1st. So I've been on the bill says June.
That was the old version. The new version is July 1st. We know it's July 1st.
Okay, well, why don't we know we'll have some added dialogue with this. Let's do that.
So this group, this group, we get that other group to convene. We're happy to
help.
Yeah. So John, I mean, John Weiss, back to your comment. The reason we put lines on underneath negotiated sell is so that the people could understand what were those in there. Jason Gardner's right. They don't have to be there, but as the group got together from our side, we thought we better have some what those kind of items are so that the people can know rather than just this figure. But again, we're not married to anything other than what the statute says and clarification. So,
Greg, thank you for all that. We're in table for right now. As you said, we'll have further discussion on this. I personally think if we could simplify it any way possible, would be good. We'll need to get general consensus from everyone. So that we don't have confusion, because I think there'll be enough in light of what we do. So I appreciate that. Are there some additional agenda items that we need to discuss?
I just would like to bring up one more thing. And myself and Larry Ball had an appointment last week, what was Wednesday?
Wednesday.
With the Attorney General's office. And I'm very confident we're going to be able to acquire an attorney.
Cool.
So we were very successful. It was like a battle. I'm not going to deny it. We were prepared. We went into they had every intention of not giving us our attorney. And I told them why we need an attorney. We had data to prove it. The concession is we're not going to get a full-time attorney like we want, but we're going to bury them with work. We're going to show them that we need a full-time attorney. And we're going to need help from the used and new industry to say, is this what we want? Now, there's lots of directions we can go from here. First off, I'm on the short downhill slide of my government career.
Wait, I am.
I'm not going to deny that. So I am a less government guy, and I'm not changing my stripes for nobody, even if I lost my job for it. Okay. So it really comes down to, as an industry, we need to decide what's the best course of action for the industry, for how it's regulated, how it's enforced. What needs to be done? Like, there's some things that I've been bringing up with my boss and the commissioners about why do we have salesman's licenses? I'm not saying we don't get rid of salesman's licenses, but why are we doing background checks on salesman's licenses when you're an entrepreneur? You're the one assuming the responsibility of who you're employing. When I charge a salesperson, we've never charged a salesperson. We charge the owners. So it really comes down to what can we do to bring honest discussion forward? Because I'm not saying Jason's probably ringing my voodoo doll that he has on me right now. But the real bottom line is that what can we do the best to prevent this type of stuff by having open decorum on what's the right and equitable thing to do as an industry and to protect the citizens and to protect all the dealers. we have lots of agencies involved in you guys' business every day. Commerce. We have the AG's office, in essence. We have motor vehicle enforcement, and you have the DMV. The tax commission has streamlined a lot of those things. We have, I'm over the DMV now for years, so, and I've seen since July 1st, the best progress forward on the DMV side of the year stuff. We are committed to guaranteeing the title papers that you guys are having. We have some things coming up moving forward that we need to talk about, like the temporary permits that are coming up for audit. What's the best thing to do? Like our temporary permits are 50 years old. We need a new course of action that takes into account dealer track systems that you guys have, that communicates that. It'll alleviate temporary permit audits. Those are the type of things that the board needs to be discussing. And if guys were taking care of things, then we wouldn't be spending time on a lot of this. So, but I'm excited about the attorney thing. I am. Thank you.
We are too. We
know. How'd you pay for them?
We're paying, you guys are paying for them on the temporary permit budget.
So why didn't they give you a full time?
What?
Why didn't they give you a full time?
Because they wanted, they said we don't have the work. I guarantee you we have the work. No, he gave us case count numbers. We have more cases coming into what they projected to us, Mike.
And they said their attorneys handle 100 a year, and we've already filed 168 in 10 months.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you'll win that.
So right now, our case count is projected to go over 11,000 cases this year.
Well,
oh. And not all of them are bad. There, a lot of those are good, but when I took over, we're below 5,000. So, yes, we've got better, and things are going to improve. But it really comes down to the disconnect part that I've been talking about is, are these issues civil? Are they criminal? What's the best thing for us to do? Like, when does it, the fraud part, the definition of fraud? Because some of our codes are written in 1950. It is 2023. We have to modernize the whole vision because some of the things we get cases rejected.
Some of the codes are still like the 1939 edition that I have upstairs.
So I think that we would like to spend more time having discussions with Sonia, having discussions with Craig, presenting things to your boards and saying, what do we need to do?
Well, we welcome that.
And that's what I want to do.
Any other items? Larry, any other items?
No, just it's renewal time.
Renewals.
We're on par. We were last year. We could be way better. And the new car dealers are lagging way behind, Craig. Craig.
Bueller.
I'm kind of going out of there because I just got scolded by somebody not having enough dealers for the meeting. I said, these guys work for me. I work for them. They don't work for me. So
it is so easy to renew.
The renewal is so easy.
Have you renewed?
Yeah.
It is so easy. What can I do to make it easier? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what I can do to make it easier. I honestly will tell you, I told my boss this, that if you guys are not renewing, it is not a state of Utah problem. We've eliminated all the BS out of renewals.
I appreciate that.
Hey, Clint has a comment. Clint?
Mr. Chairman, one more item that we could discuss quickly. I'm sure as everyone's aware, the legislative body is talking about disbanding this board. Is that something we want to talk about for just a few minutes?
The board?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we'll table that for right now.
I don't know if we have time. I don't know when that's coming up.
The 14th.
Okay.
We've had a meeting. It got shelved.
Yep. And was it that one?
It's on the agenda for the Transportation Interim Committee on the 14th.
Of June.
The position is we're neutral on it. I am a believer of the board, but there's been parameter changes that make it like the governor's office is asked that we look at and evaluate boards. Really, the fight's really in your hands. What you guys decide you want to do, what is the best use of our department for the industry? If you guys, if the industry believes that the board needs to continue, I think that argument needs to go to Craig and Sonia, and you guys need to come up with a course of action.
Well,
is that right, Jason? Did I say it correctly?
You did. And that's ultimately and I think the big takeaway here is, regardless of what happens with the board itself, I think we need to make it clear that us, the tax commission, are open to input from the industry, whether you had a collaborative effort among various industry leaders among yourselves and then presented us with recommendations, or even if you came to us a piecemeal, we're always open and receptive to those. And you know, we'll consider them. So, I mean, really, that's kind of the role of the board as it is to have us have an opportunity for people to get together and make recommendations. And really, that's, I don't know that that would end, at least not, maybe not in a formal setting, but it, any recommendation will be accepted.
Jason, are you saying that we should make a recommendation as to what we think before the 14th? And if so, who do we make that recommendation to?
You would make the recommendation to your own industry rep. So it'd be probably Craig and Sonia. And then they can appear at that transportation interim committee meeting and make their recommendations to the committee members of whether the board should be sunsetted or not. If it remains to exist, we will continue to participate. If it doesn't remain to exist, we will continue to work with the industry. So I just want to make that clear that we'll continue working with you regardless.
But Mr. Chairman, my perception would be that there would not be a formal meeting and a formal board. And so I would guess it would be less likely. When I was at the, you know, observing the, you know, it was some kind of tourism board that was kind of getting grilled. They didn't have good responses, and that's why they tabled it. I don't know if our representatives will be prepared with good responses. They wanted to know how often we're meeting, what, you know, who's attending, you know, who's being represented, what the cost is. And I knew the answer to many of those, but not all of those. And so if we want this board to continue, I think we should be prepared by June 14th and make sure that someone's going to be in charge of being there.
Okay, I hear you. I think it has merit what you're saying. What I'm hearing from the board, from Alan's group, and a little bit from Jason, what I'm hearing is that basically it's left up to Craig and Sonia, you two, to determine where your teams are.
We'll put a letter together.
Pardon?
I said the Independent Theater Association put a letter together for Sonia.
They did already.
No, we will.
Okay. It seems to me, if I'm correct,
and
I think we all have opinions about that. I know I've been in favor of this, but we can be looked at as kind of buttering our own bread, or if we're, you know, it's for us, not for the consumer. I think what we provide here is things that help the consumer and help us help the consumer. And if we don't have the kind of help we've had here, we've had such excellent help of late. If we don't have that, sometimes we don't even know about the things that we need to do to help the consumer or what's transpiring or what's taking place. And even things like this, we want it to be so it passes the acid test and works with the consumer. So I'm in favor of keeping this board, but I don't know from feedback that that's how it's looked at. It's maybe us looking out for us.
That's a great
So one. I think that we need to be proactive here. I know that I've had discussions with Craig, and we plan to show and be there in strength with our concerns and our opinions, and I would hope that you would do the same. And I think that we can collaborate by saying we're on this, if we are on the same team, we can collaborate by saying those two sides have gotten together, we believe in the best interest of what should take place for the community. We all share in this one opinion. Possibly, and I leave that up to you to discuss that
with. We actually have a board meeting next week with our board, and so it's
going to discuss this.
Okay.
We have a board meeting next week too. Don't we?
The
week
after the 14th, the day of this meeting.
Okay, we'll do some. We'll do some last stuff
or something. Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Okay. And we'll follow that angle. That's a great angle.
Okay. Any other things that we should talk about? Do we want to set a anything else?
I don't have anything.
Do you think there's anything else you want to do?
Well, the only thing that we brought this up before, I don't really know how the temporary permit amount that we charge with the state of Utah is by far the lowest in the region. Now, what I want to tell you is I am advocating that we look at addressing raising the cost of the temporary permit, but it's self-serving. I'm not going to deny that. It funds our department. And we are losing officers to higher paying jobs because we can't compete even with the highway patrol. We're benchmarked higher than the highway patrol because they have got legislative support to raise their entry level starting July 1st is $33 an hour. You're talking for a trooper in the police academy. I have investigators that have been here for some time that are making $23 an hour. And it's like, look, It is a painful reality. I know Mr. Wade is a businessman. So he looks, I pay my best people. They can't leave because I'm paying them so well. We can't do that here. And it's a frustrating thing for me because I wish I could.
How much did they increase?
I don't know. We're throwing some numbers around because we're working with UPA right now because they're saying that we're below 30% of the market. So we're 30% down in pay inequity. And they're going to make us. So what I've done, and Larry is not supporting this totally. You are supporting me, but in theory, you don't like it. We have cut 25 officers down to 16 now. In Larry's opinion, we've cut as low as we can go because our case count's gone up. Now, I will tell you this, gentlemen. I have guys that work, and I have guys that don't do jack. And they drive me crazy because I do more than they do. Like, Cole, tell them who leads the division in cases investigated last year.
Yeah, you.
Us. Three, right here. So we are carrying the mantle and holding it because I'm accountable to you guys. I'm accountable to the citizens. I'm accountable to my boss. We have failed at letting the guys below us because we are responsible and we do it. So I'm just telling you this what it is. Could I do better? Absolutely, I could do better. But ultimately, when my phone rings, I take care of it. We get it done. We are bringing guys up and they're getting better, but we are losing the guys that have potential to higher paying jobs, and it's just not right.
You only get money from the permit.
Yeah,
it's the only place you can get.
That's where we get our money, and we have been responsible. So I will tell you this: we have about over $5 million in savings because we have been fiscally responsible. So we didn't go out at the end of the year and go buy tons of equipment and buy waste money. So we have money to fund these things. We have to get legislative approval to access that money. It's basically a rainy day fund is what I'm telling you.
Do you have a recommendation that we can discuss in our various?
I don't even know how to go about this, to be honest.
The last thing we talked about was raising it to 20.
And I don't know what that number really is. What is it, 1275 right now? What is it?
1216.
1216.
What would you need to have? Who decides whether
it would have to be a legislative change? We have a range, and we're at the top of the range, and we have been for a long time. But we're still responsible in that money. We don't waste it. But I just don't know where we differ on this is I think I can get better production out of non-sworn guys. Cops are what they are, you gentlemen. I'm not going to deny it. They have a pattern. I call them cellar dwellers. Just like to do the same thing. And I need guys I want educated guys. I can't even say that anymore. I want guys with bachelor's degrees that can go in there and treat you like a respectable person until it's time for them to do their job. You've known me my whole life, right? I believe that. I've known you like most of my life. I believe that. I'm not a perfect person. I've made tons of mistakes in my life, but there's a difference between a person that's doing a heinous act and then a criminal offense as a white collar crime. Those are hard for us to hire the right guys. You've been around a long time. How many guys have you seen less fired over the last 6 years? We had a 50% turnover, and it wasn't because they liked my smiling face, because I got rid of them. How many we permits? Have the right guys now.
How many permits are issued a year?
What's the total? Vehicles? It's a lot.
Well, you know, that'd be the start of that
one. Yeah. Craig knows how to do it.
Maybe there's just a range. So we moved the range. We've done legislatively a lot. And the proposal was, as I see what you just said, they'll go looking at the fiscal analyst. They've got X amount of the kitty. Yeah, but you can't touch that. And now you want to move the range. Yeah, for a rainy day. That's a hard sell, $5 million over here, but move the range from 8 to 12. Let's move it from 12 to 18 so they can have. Used to be, we had to go back legislature every flipping year. And then what happened is we put a range, now we're at the top of the range, correct? So we simply just need to move the range. But kind of hard when you got all the kitty over here. That's the dilemma that fiscal analysts will look at that.
So how do we release that money?
I agree, it's still $5 million. That's the problem. So if we can just move the range.
And that we awesome. Saved that over a 7-year period. It wasn't like we saved that in one year.
It's because of your goodness. That's the reason.
But how do you get that released?
You don't, you just spend it as you need to.
Well, we have to do an appropriation request to do that.
For that?
Yes, and it is designed for pay, like if we, let's say the temporary permits drop by 50%. We can fund our division, and that's what it's for. I don't know, it's really a Heidi Riley question on how, she's our budget analyst, how that gets done. But what I'm trying to tell you is UPA is going to force us. Now, where I don't know where to go forward is, where this, where me and Larry we have, I wouldn't say we disagree, we have different philosophies. I still think that I could tap into my law enforcement resources and have non-sworn, because the guys don't want to do law enforcement issues. I don't need to pay a cop to do something that a what do you call them, the meter maids do. You know what I'm saying? It really comes down to that. We just haven't quite, we're closer than we've ever been, but we still, I could hire more policemen, but what am I going to do with them? I mean, I believe that we're a regulatory agency that does criminal investigation. My number one priority is renewal of the licenses that you guys can conduct business to feed and clothe your families. That wasn't what we were like before. So it really comes down to what's the best thing for us to do moving forward. We know fraud's coming in, and I know an attorney is going to help me. We're going to put the attorney over the screening committee, and they're going to be the ones that decide how we process the case instead of an investigator or a sergeant or even a lieutenant. That's going to help, but we still are required to do registration enforcement. Okay, we're not really doing registration enforcement now. We're legislatively responsible for certain items, and we're doing that, but we could be doing better. Our main focus has been the industry. So that's where we're at.
I know the Independent Dealer Association would support you guys 110%. If you need the extra tools, I think everybody in here understands the temporary permits pass through fee anyway. If it's and that helps everybody. That helps the consumer, number one.
Let's take that back to our individual groups and have a discussion. You do that, and Craig, let's do that on our end, and then let us find a way to come together with it. Something that works for everybody. Any other items that you want to bring about?
We have been funding raises through, what do you call them, vacancy savings. Mm-hmm. So when an officer leaves, I have, especially a seasoned officer, like Larry is going to retire this year. Larry has served this department for 35 years, okay? I'm losing a huge amount of knowledge. Now, when I hire somebody new, we're going to promote, Cole will get promoted, somebody else will move up. There will be savings, but just keep in mind, because the way that works, Cole's going to be making more than Larry when he gets promoted or damn close to, right? Something like that. That doesn't always make it right, but then I'll have savings on the backside when I hire a new person. That's how we fund this department since the 7 years I've been there. And our guys are going to be paid more now than ever before.
I think you better find a way to tap into that fight.
We can do that too. You know, there's a way, and there's always a way.
I tap into it because we'll find a way to get you more of that case. Any other items?
Nope.